Life Audio.
Welcome to Empowering Homeschool Conversations, your authority in navigating the world of homeschooling diverse learners. Featuring Peggy Ployer from Sped Homeschool, Annie Yorty from AnnieYorty.com, Leilani Melendez from Living with Eve, Stephanie Buckwalter from eLARP Learning, and Dawn Jackson from Dawn Jackson Educational Consulting and Tutoring. With over 75 years of combined homeschooling expertise, experiences, and perspectives, this group is eager to share their wealth of wisdom to empower your homeschooling journey. So grab your favorite mug, settle in, and get ready for insightful discussions, valuable insights, and practical tips as these experts and their guests dive into the hottest topics in homeschooling. Whether you're a seasoned homeschooler, just considering this path, or anywhere in between, you don't want to miss a minute of these enlightening conversations that will empower your child to thrive in their homeschool environment. Empowering Homeschool Conversations is starting right now. Join us to give your homeschool the power boost it needs to successfully educate the unique learners in your home.
Today, we're going to talk about strategies for conquering homeschooling challenges, tips for success. And my guest today is Dr. Douglas Petersma. Dr. Petersma is a researcher in the field of home education, a home educating father, and a curriculum writer of home education foreign language courses. His professional work includes being the editor of the Homeschool Researcher, a peer-reviewed research journal of the National Home Education Research Institute. He oversees the review and revisions of submitted manuscripts, as well as formatting of approved manuscripts for hard copy and online publishing. And he's also a researcher associate with NERI, which is that acronym. Welcome, Douglas. I'm so excited to have you on the show. We've met many times in person at different conferences, and I'm just excited for you to be able to share from your experiences, but also from your research and just the encouragement that you have through all of the content that you've written over the years on this topic. So welcome.
Thank you, Peggy. It's great to be here, and I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while. And like you said, we've met before in person, but it's always great to be able to meet like this, to be able to share what we have for the broader audience.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. It seems like this is a topic you can never talk too much about, because there's always discouragement. There's always obstacles. And sometimes we can get up to this, even the same obstacle, and it just feels different. And we need the encouragement to get past it and say, nope, this is my calling. We're going to get through it. But it's nice to know that there's other people that have faced those challenges, and that there are answers and actually proven research, that can get us also past maybe those negative, voices in our head or naysayers who are around us. So this is a great topic as we're kind of hitting that springtime season, when I think a lot of people are saying, you know, that home education thing, maybe we should be doing that next year. So good timing too. But
absolutely.
The one thing I love to do when we kick off the show is to just have our audience get to know our guest a little bit. So I would love for you to give us a little bit of background on your homeschooling journey, and just how you got involved also in research and just your passion for helping parents as well as teaching in your own home.
Certainly. Thank you for the opportunity to do that. And I won't try to repeat any of what you read in the bio. I know it was full of acronyms and long worded descriptions of what I do. But really, my family got started in home education right from the get-go. We have two children. My daughter was homeschooled starting in kindergarten all the way through high school. She graduated in 2022. My son, a few years after that, we actually didn't get him into schooling before what happened with him that actually led into us doing special education homeschooling with him. And that was his medical difficulties. And I'll describe that a little bit here because I think it's good for background. But my son was diagnosed with epilepsy at the age of 3. He He had a 45-minute tonic-clonic seizure. They used to call those grand mal seizures.
Right.
And at the time, I was over in Iraq on a deployment. Mm. My wife was at home taking care of the home front, as many military spouses do. And, of course, I ended up coming home on emergency leave. A lot of medical stuff after that. The first seizure nearly took his life. And so, of course, we went into the diagnostic phase, and they tried various medicines that seemed to work for a while, then they didn't work anymore. And in the end, he was diagnosed with what they call intractable epilepsy, which means they're not going to be able to stop seizures with medicines. As a matter of fact, he was on 4 anti-epileptic meds simultaneously, and all that was doing was suppressing his major seizures, but he was still having smaller breakthrough seizures. And he would have those sometimes, not every day, but some days he would have 50 seizures in a day. And they could be as simple as what we call drop seizures. So he would just lose muscle control and fall to the ground, or what we call absent seizures. There's a whole education on epilepsy that I learned just when my son went through that. But the bottom line was this: he got a diagnosis that said he's not going to be helped with meds as far as seizure control. And the good prognosis for him was that he probably wasn't going to develop past the level of a kindergarten. And I'm talking like on into adulthood. He would have maintained, you know, that level of cognitive ability at best. At worst, it could have taken his life. He was having so many seizures, it was a very high likelihood that he was not going to have a very long life. So what we ended up settling on, recommended by the doctors, a difficult decision for parents, but yet it wasn't hard for us to make the decision. I often call it a decision that was easy to make. So he ended up going through what they call a hemispherectomy. And that's basically where they go into the brain, to the part of the brain that's misfiring, causing the seizures, and they literally remove it. They take it out.
Wow.
Some patients will lose the entire hemisphere, 4 lobes on one side of their brain. My son had 1 lobe on the right side of his brain removed, so it was resected and taken out of his head. Another lobe was disconnected, still functionally lives within his brain, but doesn't interact with the brain or the body. So overall, functionally and physically, he lost 25% of his brain. And that's, I mean, this is with a almost 5-year-old. So it was 2 years between his initial seizure to the surgery. So he wasn't even at kindergarten yet. Like, he would have been right about that age, if you want to use the age. But this left him with a physical disability. It's called hemiparesis. If you've ever seen a stroke patient that loses muscle control on one side of their body.
Right.
But his is permanent. And he also has a cognitive deficit because of the surgery, but he also has a cognitive deficit because of the seizures, the sheer number of seizures that he had over that span of 2 years. The one thing we can praise God for is he is now coming up on 13 years seizure-free. So the surgery worked.
That's amazing.
Obviously, it had the side effects that we were anticipating, the motor skills deficiencies. But at this point, you know, those are just so secondary to the fact that he's with us. He's alive. He's 17 years old. He's 5 inches taller than me. He's super active. He still has a lot of challenges, physical and cognitive. But this kind of led us into we're already homeschooling. Our oldest was already doing homeschooling. Our son has all of these therapies post-surgery. He was having 5 to 7 hours of therapy per week, occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy, you name it, he was having it. And so we're like, okay, now we need to think about school. It wasn't our priority list when he was coming through recovery.
You know, absolutely not.
That when we get to that. But then when we did get there, you know, we went for the common thinking that I find a lot of parents do. And this is probably one of the biggest things for us to overcome. It's the overcoming the idea that as parents are just not capable of handling that situation. So we looked at our daughter. I used the term neurotypical. So she didn't have any cognitive deficits. Okay, we can handle her school. But his school, we didn't think we could handle. We said, there's got to be an expert out there, that we need the expert. We need a special program. And so with our son, we did start him doing school from home. He ended up starting with a virtual school. So he had a special education assigned teacher, and he would be in a special education virtual classroom 1 or 2 times a week. And then he would have some one-on-one time with the same special education teacher. And we thought, okay, that's what we need to do because he has these needs. Well, as we learn and as we grew, we realized that as parents, there was so much capability residual in us as parents.
Oh, yeah.
And what he was getting through the virtual school, although the staff was great and the teachers were dedicated, and I have no complaint about them, they were still limited. That one special education teacher virtually was still working with 30 plus students. He still wasn't getting the amount of time that we thought he probably should have or could have gotten. And in those virtual schools, the parents do a lot of the teaching anyway.
So yeah, absolutely.
When we take a step back, we're thinking, we're already pretty much homeschooling him. I know he's in this program. As he got into, I think it was probably second or third grade, we started noticing some content that was of concern for us. And of course, it's a public school program, so you know there's going to be content at some point that if you have a Christian faith tradition, you're not going to be cool with. We weren't. And so that's really when we decided to kind of take the leap and let's do this full force. We're going to be the homeschool teachers. And we thought it was a pretty good fit. My wife has a teaching background. She went through college, got a teaching degree, taught Christian school for 3 or 4 years before we met married. Once our daughter was born, she pretty much just focused on her. But she has that background, taught in elementary. Yeah. So we thought, okay, this is a good pairing. I personally had no experience or background in the field of education at that time.
Right.
So like most homeschool families, my wife did most of the day-to-day instruction. And I was active duty military, worked full time. I would come home. I would help where I needed to, curriculum decisions, things of that nature, discipleship, family discipleship kind of stuff. But I wasn't hands-on with the education of our children at that point. But I was able to complete my military service obligation in 2015, at which point I took over my daughter's education. So I was focusing on my daughter. My wife was focusing on my son, kind of split the responsibilities, make it a little easier on my wife. And then about 2 years later, my wife took a job, a career opportunity that came up, and I took on my son's responsibilities. So since about 2017, I've had both of them. Of course, my daughter graduated a couple years ago, so I'm now back down to one. And the whole time, we've just been learning and growing. About 2 years into me actually taking a more active role in teaching my children, I started a postgraduate program at Regent University. And so it was great. We sat in the same room. I sat at my desk doing my postgraduate work. My daughter was on one side of me. My son was on the other side of me. And we just learned together all day, every day. And my wife's career, actually, she's able to do that from home. So literally, we were still all together. So that's kind of the background about how we got into where we are right now with homeschooling. I don't know if that kind of wraps up the first question you were asking. And if there's anything you need to interject before I ramble on.
Well, I think, too, it helps our audience to understand that you get where a lot of them are at, because, when you, Deborah, who's watching, says military, hats off to you. You get our community because you've lived it. And so the advice, that you're sharing, it comes through that lens that, you aren't going to give parents an answer of, life is all all good. Just smile through it and it'll all work out. We have a lot of hard days and a lot of hard experiences that change us, as you your son's experiences did. And like you said, you got a whole education in things that you weren't prepared to get an education in. And that's where our community often finds ourselves.
We will continue this conversation after a short break.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
This is Empowering Homeschool Conversations, provided by Sped Homeschool, a nonprofit that empowers families to home educate diverse learners. To learn more, visit spedhomeschool.com.
How did you, it looks like circumstances forced the hand a lot, but you were already homeschooling before that. Did you have any qualms with homeschooling your daughter, in getting started, or was that just pretty much we're going to do this?
Well, it's kind of funny because when you talk about why did you start homeschooling, I love the question because If you ask me why I homeschool now and you ask me why I started homeschooling then, the answers are not the same.
Yeah.
Our initial thought process was I'm in the military. I'm going to move every couple of years. My wife has a background in teaching. Let's keep our children's education consistent, smooth. If we have to make a military move in the middle of a school year, as a homeschool family, you stop, you move, you get to your new location, you pick it back up, and you go on. And there's no break. There's no discontinuity, if you want to call it that. So that was our motivation. Our motivation was pragmatics. It was very practical for us to be able to do that. As I got into studying education in general, I came to what I would call a conviction. It is my conviction that as a Christian family, it is the parents' responsibility to teach and train, to raise, to disciple their children. And there's absolutely no way I can do that if between kindergarten and 12th grade, they spend 15, 16, 17,000 hours under the tutorage of individuals who either are not following the word of God, or perhaps they want to follow the word of God, but they're restricted because they're in an environment where they're not allowed to even talk about the Bible or God or prayer or whatever. So it really did become a conviction along the lines. And of course, the more I've looked into it, the more I realize the benefits of it, the efficacy of home education, the value of it, not just for special needs homeschooling, but including special needs homeschooling. And so the more I have learned, the more I have come to conclude, and I make some pretty bold statements. I will say this, and it sometimes kind of takes people aback a little bit about what I think about home education and how it can be used, and especially as it relates to home education. But that's really come from the years of practical experience and study and research. And hopefully I don't come across as a know-it-all, because I'm telling you, I'm still learning every day, every time I read papers, every time I read books. Sometimes I'm reading books about stuff that's actually contradictory, like they're trying to counter homeschooling efforts. And I will read those too, because I want to know what those arguments are to be able to actively and effectively present the information that I have in a reasonable way that makes sense to those people as well. So,
That's great. And our reason for homeschooling can change over time too. Even if it doesn't change because of our children, their circumstances, like you said, and so many other things. But I think a lot of people have a hard time getting over that first hurdle of the obstacles that they see in the way, and getting past those to say, okay, this is definitely what we're going to do and we can do it. Can you counteract some of those, the big ones?
So I like to start off conversations like this with something that may sound a little academic. I'm not going to try to get that way. But I will say this, the biggest hurdle to overcome, and it really is an umbrella issue, because once you put this in its right perspective, a lot of other little things can be tied to it. The biggest obstacle to overcome for most families is overcoming the paradigm of schooling. I will make this distinction every day, multiple times. Schooling and education are not the same thing. And in our society, we have come to understand almost that those words are synonymous. Schooling, kindergarten through 12, academic achievement. And we've gotten to the place where those two things are so tied together. If you go back to the history of it, and I'm not going to do an entire history lesson today because that is an awesome study that I encourage everybody to do. If you go back to the history of it, homeschooling is not new. Homeschooling is not the experiment. In the grand scheme of history, schooling is the experiment. Yeah. And if you read anything by people like John Taylor Gatto, you'll know that it's an experiment that has proven to be a failure in many, many respects. Mm-hmm. So what I like to say is first obstacle to overcome is overcome the schooling paradigm. And here's what I mean by that. We get in our mind, if we were raised in either public schools, private schools, Christian schools, whatever, my wife and I both went to small church-run Christian schools, K through 12. Hmm. We actually went to schools that use the exact same curriculum. So my wife and I have that as a kind of a starting point when we started working with our children. Hmm. But you think about things in terms of grade levels. You think about mm-hmm. things in terms of grading, you know, letter yeah. grades, A, B, C, D, whatever it happens to be. You think about things like a schedule. You're going to do school from such and such a time in the morning to such and such a time in the afternoon. You're going to do school from September to May, or nowadays schools start way earlier than September. They go way later than May. I don't know. We'll try to figure that out. All of those things, the schedule, the grade levels, the competitive grading, the trying to keep people on track, on grade level, on pace, all of those things I put under the umbrella of this phrase: educationally ineffective schooling paradigms. And I have a couple of online articles out there, and I use the acronym EISP for educationally ineffective schooling paradigms. Those are all of the things that have to be in place because a school is a school, because it has to be organized, because you have to divide the children up somehow. So what are you going to do? You're going to divide them up by age, or if there's a certain portion of children that have cognitive difficulties, you're going to put them in a special education class, or you're going to have advanced placement class for those students who are ahead in a particular subject or another. You have to have those divisions and those separations, classes. You're going to assign teachers to a certain number of students, student-teacher ratios, all of that kind of stuff. But if we completely tear ourselves away from that, we open ourselves up amazingly to so many opportunities. I will give you an example. Ever since my son was pulled out of that virtual academy that I talked about earlier, he has never done a school year in a school grade. So if you ask my son, what grade are you in? I don't know, 9th, 10th, 11th. The answer is yes, because he's in all three at the same time. He has he has challenges in certain areas, so he may be in a lower grade level on those. He has skills that he can do, even as a special education student. My son is very math and science focused. So his math and science, believe it or not, foreign language. He does well at foreign language, even with his a cognitive disability that affects his reading in English, he still picks up verbal interaction in foreign language studies very, very well. So he's in multiple grade levels, and we don't care what grade level he's in, and we're not tied to that schooling paradigm. So that's how it opens up the aperture of what we can do. We're not tied to start in September at the beginning of this curriculum and be at the end of that curriculum at the end of May.
Right.
We're not.
Yeah.
He takes 2 years to do some of his 1 year curriculum. Perfectly fine. He's got another curriculum he can move faster through. He moves faster through it. When he's done with it, he's done with it. Yeah. So that is probably the biggest obstacle that I recommend. Mm. And this, again, this is across the board. All homeschoolers, break away from the schooling paradigms. It's kind of a joke around our house, but I'll ask my son, what's the best thing you like about homeschooling? And oftentimes his response is something along the lines of, I don't have to raise my hand to ask permission to go to the bathroom. And the answer, and it's true.
Yeah. Right?
We know how we work as a family. He does what he needs to do when he needs to do it. We're not tied to any of the paradigms. We're not even tied to the schedule. You know, we get sick a couple of days this week, so we can do some schoolwork on the weekends to make up for that if we want to. Or we can just slide it down a few days and
and
we're good. Now, as it comes to parents with children who have special needs, or that's a lot of times what they're called. I don't know if there's a better term. I like the term unique learner. I like to call my son a unique learner. but I understand special needs is the term that is most broadly understood across the board. I would say this, the next thing other than overcoming schooling paradigms, don't get tied to all of that schedule, grade level, on track, ahead of schedule, whatever.
Yeah.
Is also overcoming the obstacle of expectations. Again, this ties in. That's why I say schooling paradigms is an umbrella. Tying into that is the expectation. The expectations that at a certain age, my child is going to be doing X, Y, and see.
Right. We will continue this conversation after a short break.
This is Empowering Homeschool Conversations, provided by Sped Homeschool, a nonprofit that empowers families to home educate diverse learners. To learn more, visit spedhomeschool.com.
Mm-hmm. Because who set that standard? Who decided that all five-year-olds need to be able to do X, Y, and Z?
Exactly.
And I've done a lot of the background research. There's a book by a gentleman named Dr. Raymond Moore. The book came out in 1975. It is old. It's called Better Late Than Early. And he started looking way back then at how different boys and girls learn and how at different ages children come into a state where now they are ready to learn reading. And I've talked to so many homeschoolers that say, you know what? My child was 9 or 10 years old before they were quote unquote reading effectively. And in high school, they got no problems. Yeah. They are, they're consuming books by the dozens or whatever it happens to be. And that's not every case. My son still has reading challenges. Mm-hmm. He's 17 years old. If you gave him a book and said, this book is good for a 17 year old, he should probably be able to read it. He could probably stumble his way through it, but we're going to give him something that interests him. I don't care what level it's at. It can be at an advanced level. He's interested. He's going to find out what those words mean. It can be at a lesser level, if you want to call it that. And he's still going to find interest in reading that. So overcoming the expectations of where should my child be? Anytime somebody says my child is or isn't on grade level, I want to ask who set the grade level? Who set the expectation that that's where your child needs to be? I'll give you a couple more examples for my son specifically. Yeah. There's an expectation in school that children can sit still. And if anybody's ever homeschooled,
then no, they cannot.
any boy, especially boys, right? Any boy under the age of what? Maybe 10, maybe not even, maybe even beyond that. If you've tried to homeschool a boy or do any kind of schooling with a boy and say, okay, you're going to sit here for the next hour and work on worksheets or read a book or whatever it is you're going to do, chances of that happening is nil. So my son, one of the things that was a result of his surgery was he had what's called repetitive motion syndrome. And so for a number of years after his surgery, you would find him doing this. He would sit and he would rock. And it was constant. I mean, he was constantly in motion. So we talked to his therapists and doctors and they're like, well, that's, you know, part of the brain surgery. And some children have that as an effect of other conditions. I don't even know the exhaustive list of those. But we figure this, if we try to strap him down, tie him in, and I don't mean literally, but if we try to lock him in to a still position, he's going to get nothing done. So when it came to things where we could have him in motion, I call him an in motion learner. He likes to move. He likes to move while he's doing things. And I thought, well, this is going to be terrible when it comes to handwriting. Like, how do you teach handwriting if the child is constantly in motion? And we solved that problem by putting a pad under his desk, got him a chair with wheels on it. He could put his feet under the bar in front of him. He could actually move his chair back and forth, but his hand wasn't moving. His hand could still write. So his body is in motion while his hand. And this is just specific to him. I know every child's going to be different. Mm-hmm. I thought he's going to have terrible handwriting. Well, guess what? I, as a kid, had terrible handwriting. His handwriting is way better than mine ever was at his age. So we figured a way to allow him to do what he needs to do. You put that in a schooling paradigm, though. You put that in a classroom. You can't have a child constantly in motion in that.
No.
My son is also an out loud learner. And this is probably another effect from both his epilepsy and his brain surgery. But he loves to do his work out loud. He wants to read through his material. Even though his reading is a challenge, if I tell him to sit and read this page silently, first of all, he never even gets through the page. Or he just, you know, daydream is often. But having him say it out loud keeps him going, even if he's struggling through the reading, which, by the way, he's gotten tons better at. I love where he's at on his reading level. He's an out loud learner. And that became something that we had to consider when I was in a room. I'm at my desk. My daughter's at her desk. My son's at his desk. He's an out loud learner. How do we keep her from being distracted? Well, she is a lover of classical music. We got her headphones.
Yeah.
We play classical music softly over her headphones. Mm-hmm. She did all of her work in silence, listening to music all day long. My son's over in his corner of the room. He can talk as loud as he wants as far as going through his material. And he still does it to this day. Like, he does all of his history and science by reading everything out loud. And it also helps me, because unless I'm literally looking over his shoulder, sometimes I can't necessarily see, hey, he's reading something and he may have mispronounced something or gotten something a little askew. Well, now I hear it because he's reading it out loud. I can make those corrections on the spot. And I don't even like to think about them as corrections. I like to think of them as simply like course changes. We're just making sure his vector's on. And of course, he takes it very well. So those are some of the expectations that I think we need to overcome as parents of special needs homeschoolers. It's not just the expectations of grade level. It's not just the expectations of sit still and learn. It's not just the expectations of be quiet while you do your schoolwork. But all of those together are something that we can overcome. And that just opens up a world of possibilities. Your school doesn't have to be in your room today. It's a nice weather outside. We're going to go sit on the deck. We're going to do it out there. In the winter, I live in Wyoming. It's too cold to go outside. What are we going to do? We're going to sit in front of the fireplace. And we're going to do our schoolwork. And so we have actually gone from a school room to no specific designated school space. My son has a desk in his room. He can do some of his work there. We can sit out on the couch in front of the fireplace. We can sit out on the deck under the shade tent. We can go sit in the yard if we want to. All of those things are wide open. Try to do that with a classroom of 30 students and good luck.
Yeah. That's a really great way to really help us to understand why we do the things that we do. Because I think it's nice to say, well, how do we get started homeschooling? How do we get over those obstacles? But what is it that is causing us to think that things are obstacles in the first place? You know, taking that step back a little further. And then when we run into things like that too, to just ask ourselves, why do I think this way? I think that's a great point that you make, that we have this shift that has happened in our society because we have normalized schooling and really taken that to mean education, when it really is the framework that education traditionally happens in now in our society.
Yeah, and I will encourage, you know, parents of special needs homeschoolers with a couple of things, and that is this. These are those bold statements I was talking about earlier that kind of catch people a little off guard. I have said this and written articles with this idea and title in them. Parents are the perfect teachers for special needs homeschool students, and that's a pretty bold statement. I know that. So the question is, of course, how do you back that up, right?
Right.
Well, you've probably heard this. I'm sure you've had people on your show that talk about this before. But parents know their children so well that they just have an innate sense of where they are, what their interests are, what they can do, their proclivities, their challenges. And every time I talk about a child's challenges, I always also want to counterbalance that. Because for every child that has a challenge – they typically will also have some sort of exceptional ability. You've probably heard the term twice exceptional. You know, they may have a deficit in one area, but they have, you know, a skill, an advanced skill in another area. You've probably all heard stories about, you know, children who had great deficits, but they could play piano great or something, you know, some sort of savant capability.
Yeah.
And a parent is going to know that. When you think about a teacher that gets to know a group of children, and 9 months later, that group is gone. They get a new group the next year. They're trying to do what a parent does in 1 year, but a parent has been with that child 4 years continuously, no breaks. So much is known about the child. A parent knows their child better than anybody else. A parent loves their child more. Now, this is not to say that those in the schooling industry do not love children. Many of them do. Mm-hmm. Many of them show that love. And I don't ever want to disparage the effort and the time that they put in, but they can't love them like you do. You are the parent. They cannot possibly spread their amount of love and emotion across that body of students And it certainly isn't going to carry on over the years. There are a few scenarios where a teacher may carry on for a couple of years. I know some special needs programs try to keep the same teacher for a couple of years so that they know the students better. That's great, but they're not going to keep them for their entire academic career. Love makes that difference. The love of a parent towards their child makes that difference in how far they will go to help their child. Love will extend the patience that the parent has with that child. Now, I understand most of us would all say we probably need more patience. Don't pray for it. God will give you the challenge.
Yeah, yeah. You get opportunities, lots of them.
Exactly. But we do. We're already there. When you think about a challenge like my son's medical needs and the patience that we have to have with him just to do ordinary everyday things.
Right.
That extends to the academics. That extends to the rest of life. Even the most dedicated special education teacher or staff is never going to know your child the way you do, never going to love them the way you do. They're never going to be able to educate them the way you do because of how much you know. So I say parents are the perfect teachers. And when a parent may think of teacher qualifications, that's a schooling paradigm. I push that off to the side. The classes that teachers have to take to become certified teachers, most of them do not have to do with actual instruction, passing on information, academic achievement. They have to do with classroom management. They have to do with, you know, administrative things that teachers have to go to. You cut out all of that middleman, if you will, in the education process when you have them at home, you teach them, or you bring them home, whichever the case may be. And so I say parents are the perfect teachers, and I mean it. I really do. I think they are the ones that have the best opportunity. But I also say, here's a really bold statement, that home education is the perfect solution for special needs students. And when I say that, again, I'm gonna clarify, I don't mean how I home educate my child is the perfect solution. I just mean that home education opens up the door to all of the opportunities so that a parent can select exactly what is perfect for their child. You send them to a school, the school has a set of curriculum. Even in the special education department, it is limited as to what they can use. You as a parent have no limitations. You can experiment. You can do whatever you need to do to find the best working curriculum. And again, I don't even expect parents to be tied so side by side with the curriculum that you can't even break free of that. You use a curriculum as a guide. It sends you down a path. You may take a deviation on that path that gets your child so much more than the curriculum was ever intended to get them. And if they don't get something that's in that curriculum, that's okay too.
That's fine.
That's what they needed at the moment. So I don't expect parents to find a perfect way and adopt it. What I ask parents to do, especially when it comes to special needs homeschooling, I say, find what works best for you and your child and your family and the entire situation that you find yourself in. And it will never look like any other single family's way of doing home education. When you get down to it and you have tailored, tweaked, experimented, picked curriculum, picked teaching methods, picked methods of, or identified your child's methods of learning and how they best receive that instruction. When you do that, there are so many variables. It will not look like anybody else's school. So what you will do is you will not find a perfect way and adopt it, but you will find your perfect way. So home education is the perfect solution for special needs students because it gives you every possible opportunity to find, develop, and implement your perfect way in home education. Different curriculums, styles of learning, styles of teaching. And then there's two academic terms that I'd like to bring up because I've used these in articles that I've written. You know, academics like to prove things, right? Let's do all the quantitative studies and draw the correlations and the causation between X and Y or whatever it happens to be. There are a couple of things if you read out there in the literature that have been shown to be predictors of academic achievement in students. And this is across the board. It is not related specifically to special needs, although it does apply. And I think it is more pertinent to students with special needs. But the first thing is this. The first thing is parental involvement. If you look at parents who are involved in their children's education, and I'm talking about someone who goes to a school, but their parents know what they're doing. They know the subjects they're in. They know what they're studying. They're encouraging their children. They're giving them supplemental things that they can do that help them, whatever. That student is more likely to have a higher academic outcome. That's a schooling system. But home education parents have literally taken to the apex, to the summit, the idea of parental involvement. There is no greater parental involvement than you picking, teaching, changing, modifying what you're doing. You are literally hands-on in every aspect. So there literally can be no greater parental involvement in a child's education than home education. And for that reason, and perhaps that reason alone, you could say this is a valuable and a practical way for me to educate my children. Now, that doesn't mean it's easy. It doesn't mean it's not work. It obviously is. You have to take the time, the effort. There's probably going to be some cost. You talk about cost of a parent that stays home as opposed to going to work. Yes, those costs are there. It is a sacrifice. But I haven't met one parent yet that says, my child is not worth the sacrifice. I think we all would say that. And so when you realize, yes, it's a sacrifice, but if I put the sacrifice in, what I'm going to get out at the other end is not silver and gold. It is a child who has come through this process and is now ready for whatever God has him to do. So that's the first thing, parental involvement. It's correlated with student academic achievement. The next two things are kind of tied together. One is student-teacher ratios. If you've ever heard about school districts talking about, I need more money because we need more teachers so that we can have lower student-teacher ratios. It's kind of an obvious thing. It's kind of an obvious thing to say. You got a teacher with 40 students. They're not going to be able to accomplish as much as that teacher will with 10 students. And even in some of the biggest homeschool families, which, by the way, there's a lot of them. I'm not one of them. I only have two. But I have a sister who has 15. And even and they're a homeschooling family. So even in those huge families, your student teacher ratio is still extremely
low.
Pretty much lower than anything you're going to get in a schooling environment, because typically once the oldest students start getting to a certain level, they become teachers of the younger students. So it's not just mom trying to teach 15 students. It's mom plus the oldest ones teaching the middle ones, teaching the younger ones. It's a collaborative effort. It's a combined synergistic effort in teaching that just makes so much more outcome from that. And I have seen that in a number of families. So student teacher ratios is one of the big, again, predictors of student academic outcome. One that's tied to that is called academic engagement time or academic learning time. And this is one where you're like, okay, now he's going to go into the academic a little bit, just a little into the
week. Just a little bit. Okay.
Academic engagement time is the amount of time a teacher directly spends engaged with the student and where that student is in turn engaged with the teacher. So take, for instance, a class of 30 students. And in an hour-long class, a teacher engages as much as he or she can with each individual student over the course of an hour. At most, every student in that class gets 2 minutes of academic engagement time.
Mostly.
So whenever that teacher is engaged with one student, the other students, they may be listening, but that's passive. That's not active. So the passive engagement time does not correlate to student achievement. The academic, the active academic engagement time, that correlates to student progress. In a homeschool, I have two. So I work with my children for an hour. Each one's going to get, on average, 30 minutes. Well, we also know that because my son needs more time, he gets a little bit more time. My daughter didn't need as much time. She was able to do things independently. She got the freedom to do that. We adjust it as necessary so that each child received the optimum amount of academic engagement time. Sometimes in the literature, it's called academic learning time, ALT or AET are the acronyms that are used. But if you look for those in the literature, you'll find that AET, ALT is correlated with student academic achievement. So all of these things that the schools have said, these are the big things in academic achievement, parental involvement, student-teacher ratios, academic engagement time, and all three of those things happen naturally in a home education environment. We don't even have to try. What the schooling system needs a program to implement, home educators typically will implement without even trying. So that's why I make a bold statement. I make a bold statement that parents are the perfect teachers for their children, especially for special education children. I make a bold statement that home education is the ideal solution for special needs students, and you could say more broadly for students in general. And so that's kind of the position I come from. I hope it doesn't sound sometimes as arrogant as perhaps it sounds even in my ear as I say it, but really it does come from that, the research and the background and the studies on, hey, this is what you want in a schooling environment. I already have that in a home education environment. So let's move on to the next thing that helps my children learn as much as they can.
Right. Yeah. You don't have to focus on the, the setup process, because you've already got everything going for you. Like you said, I love what you just said. so important. The few things I want to really point out to parents, because it relates to a lot of the questions that we often get, is that homeschool freedom and then trying to find that the way to teach my child. And you hit the nail on the head when you said everybody is going to look different. And I think parents have to realize this very quickly, because you feel like you're banging your head against the wall going, well, I want to homeschool. Maybe what they're doing is going to work and what they're doing is going to work. And we chase these trails of what everybody else is doing because it seems to work for them, but your child's unique and you've got to figure out what's going to work for you and your child. And if you have it in your mind that that's what you're pursuing, instead of you're pursuing something that mimics what everybody else is doing, it's going to be so much easier.
Absolutely.
That parent time, it is so, so important. And I love how you with even your own experience, you balance that out. It's yes, your daughter just didn't need as much time. It taught her how to be an independent learner too. So we can look at it as a negative, but for the kids in those situations, God knew how much time you have and how much time each child needs. And, just leave it in his hands with
absolutely.
That. So we had a couple questions come in from some viewers, and I'd love to address those. Carissa asked, how to navigate a lack of energy and low frustration tolerance since I'm the teacher of my child?
So this is a great one, because I'm going to go back to that overarching obstacle that I talked about at the beginning, the getting away from schooling paradigms. First thing I would recommend is a change of mindset. Mm. I like to think of home education as nothing more than extended parenting. So home education isn't so much about me being my child's teacher as it is about me being my child's parent. From the very beginning, I mean, you have a child, they're a baby, they need all the attention, they're a toddler growing up. All through those years, before they ever hit anything that looks like school, what are we doing? We're teaching them. We're teaching them how to hold a spoon. We're helping them as they learn how to walk. And maybe there's some things you just be like, okay, they're going to learn it on their own. And they do. My children have done that in certain respects. I tried to teach my daughter how to ride a bike. Didn't work. I went on a deployment one time, came back. She knew how to ride a bike. I'm like, okay, that's great. She learned it on her own. But as parents, we're facilitating the learning of our children even before they ever hit school. And so if we keep in our mind the mindset that I'm not going to stand up here as a teacher in front of my children and teach my children facts and figures, and yes, they're going to learn those things, but that's not what I'm doing. What I'm doing is I'm extending that parental paradigm out into what we would call the academic world. The same patience that you need when you're teaching them how to hold a spoon and learning to walk and potty training and whatever it is that you're doing is the same patience and the same tolerance. And yes, there are going to be times where they're frustrating. There are frustrating moments. My wife and I are very different in our teaching styles. So when my children came under me as their primary teacher, there was a little bit of friction for time in how she
worked
things versus how I work things. You know, I've got this, sort of military mindset, and I had to break some of my own paradigms. I had to really stop and tell myself, okay, these are not your military troops. I had those for right. years. These are your children, right? And so I had to break out of even my patterns because I instructed military members in intelligence analysis. That was part of my job. Mm. And yes, I had that as an instructional background, as an educational experience, but I couldn't apply that to my son trying to do his fourth grade math. It just didn't work.
Right.
So yeah. I had to change. I had to break away from, again, the schooling, the classroom mindset and bring it into the parenting paradigm. And then schooling flows much easier when it is not so academically rigidly structured. So again, the expectations. We talked about expectations earlier. To take a step back from this question, I don't know if this is the fact, but it kind of seems like there are expectations perhaps for academic achievement, perhaps for academic grade level attainment. Take a step back from that. Take a step back from the schooling paradigms of expectations. That certainly does release the stress in a lot of situations. I've got to get the curriculum done. They've got to get a certain grade. All of that stuff goes away when you come away from that. Here's another big one for the frustration thing is I like to encourage parents to capitalize on children's inherent interests and talents.
Yes.
So I'll give an example of that. And this may not apply to perhaps elementary school age kids, but generally it applies across the board. My son is interested in meteorology and he's my special needs learner. Science and math are hard, but science and math are a big part of meteorology. Right. So we try to tie as much of his reading, as much of his science, as much of his math, even history. We try to tie as much of that as we can into his inherent interest for meteorology. I don't know how many times we've been sitting out on the deck in the middle of doing something and all work stops because we're going out there and we're staring up at the sky and we're identifying cloud types or whatever. And those are great opportunities. You say, wait a minute, I'm not getting the other schoolwork done that I want to do. And for me, I don't care. That is a learning interest. I'm going to capitalize on that. If your child likes dinosaurs, then when you're reading, you're going to get books about dinosaurs. And if your child, whatever they're interested in, that's how, if you can gear whatever you're doing so that honestly, our children don't see schooling as this laborious task for no specific purpose, but it's a capitalization of what they're learning. And I honestly believe God has given every child natural interests, natural inclinations, natural talents that we as parents can capitalize on. And I could not lay out a program for your child and their interests and talents and abilities. I can't do it because I don't know them.
Yeah.
You can, and you can tailor things left and right. Now that doesn't mean you say, well, my child doesn't like math, so I'm never going to teach him math. Of course you're going to teach him math, but do it in some way that comes across as fun. I mean, I don't know how many homeschool parents I've talked to where they say, you know what? We're working fractions. What are we going to do? We're going to get in the kitchen and we're going to bake cookies. Why? Because you're going to get all the measuring cups out and we're going to work fractions.
Right.
You take a recipe and double it. Take a recipe and half it. Whatever you got to do. And voila, you're working math. And the kids are like, yeah, I get cookies out of this. Fine. That's an interest. That's the motivation. The next thing that I might suggest as I read that question from Teresa is schedule. Oftentimes, parents are frustrated with a process because they're trying to do a schedule. They want to do a full day of school. They want to do the full calendar of school. So again, that's a schooling paradigm and one that I consider educationally ineffective schooling paradigm.
It is not.
If we can break out of that schedule, then do it. If you can take your day and spread it out, put bigger breaks in the middle of your day if you need them. A lot of times with special needs learners, I have had parents tell me, and this has been the case with my child, you can't just start at 7 o'clock in the morning and go through till 4 p.m.
No.
Or at some point there is just a shutdown, right?
Major shutdown.
And most of us have found that perhaps smaller chunks of time spread out with breaks in between or whatever it is that child needs will accomplish way more. So let's say I do 3.5 hours worth of work, but I spread it out across the day. I will probably get more progress out of my child doing that than if I sit him down for 7 hours with maybe a lunch break in the middle and try to push through everything. You will literally accomplish the same or more with half or less than the time. And again, I'm spouting numbers. It varies with every single child. It's going to vary. So I would encourage not to be child tied to the schedule. And I'm talking about calendar or daily schedule or anything that it might happen to be.
Well, and that could help too with mom's lack of energy. I mean, take a break, mom. Yeah. Take a
break.
if your child needs a break, you need a break. Take a break.
Love it.
You have authority over that.
There was actually a period of time with my children that we literally scheduled a nap. And I'm not talking about like toddler children. I'm talking about they were middle school. And it was like right after lunch, we would all lay down for like 30 minutes. Just let's lay down and crash. We didn't even have to go to sleep. Just lay down, relax, close your eyes, have some music playing on in the background. And so we did that. So that was a really good one.
Yeah. So we had a question too from Deborah. She said, advice for walking on eggshells between cannot and will not.
Okay, well, I'm going to take this one on kind of in the same vein as the last one, but maybe come at it from a different perspective. As I read a question like this, it speaks to me that the child sometimes does not want to do things. And how, as parents, do we differentiate between the times that they don't want to do things and the times that they're just, able to do those things?
Right.
And especially with our special needs students, right? We as parents have a direct insight into what they are able to do. But I would take it back to this. I would take it back again to parenting. I would take it back to that extension of parenting. We know our children best. So 9 times out of 10, we know what our children can do. And if we use those situations where there's a little bit of struggle, we think they can do it or we've seen them do it before. And again, some children, what they can do in one moment is not necessarily what they're able to
change
do immediately
in
the next moment. But we as parents are in the perfect position to know that. So even though it can be frustrating, you take it back to things such as simple. Take it out of academics. Let's go out to something simple in life. I don't want to brush my teeth. Well, you're going to brush your teeth, and you're going to brush your teeth because I know you need to, and you can give them all the reasons, or perhaps they're too young to even listen to all the reasons, but you are going to find a way to discipline so that they are encouraged to do the things they need to do, or they are discouraged from doing the things that would be dangerous or unhealthy or whatever it happens to be. So I would say, instead of looking at it from an academic perspective, this cannot, will not paradigm, I would look at it from that parenting perspective. What am I going to do from a discipline perspective? I know every family has their standards for discipline and what they want to do and what their expectations are for their children. I would implement those just as you would implement that parenting expectation for a behavior, not academic. Use that same sort of mind process to encourage your children to do what they should do, or perhaps not do what they shouldn't do. It's in a matter of determining whether or not they are able to do something. This is where I find incentives are really, really great. My son loves to watch Thursday night football during the NFL season. So I lay out his week's worth of work and I tell him if he's done by Thursday, by the end of our scheduled time on Thursday, he gets Friday off and he gets to stay up late and watch football on Thursday night. And what this does is that interest, that desire, that motivation then sparks him to do things. And that is often when I have realized my son can do something that before I was unsure whether or not he could do that. But because the motivation was in place, he showed me what he could do, and I totally use it against him. So the next time he goes to do something, he's like, I don't know that I can get, 3 pages of that done in the next hour. And I'm like, I know you can because I've seen you do it when you're motivated. And then, of course, then that helps him understand that his work is literally about his personal motivation. My children are different. My son wanted to work through his schoolwork and get more time off at the end of the week. Like he tries to do 5 days worth of work, get that Friday off. He does 5 days worth of work in four.
Yeah.
My daughter wanted time off every day. She wanted to get her daily goals done and stop. And then she had time to do her interest driven activities. Hers is art and literature. So she did lots of art. I could have counted like 15 credits of art for her because she just did art so much. It was great. I didn't, but I could have. So her motivation was different. She was okay with doing school on Friday because she got off in the middle of the afternoon pretty much every day through high school because she was done with her daily allotment of work. So that motivation helps us find what our children can do. And then we apply that in future situations. So hopefully that helps yeah. with the cannot, will not dilemma. It yes. may not be a perfect answer, but I honestly believe that parents can find those perfect answers, even if my answer wasn't the perfect one.
I know. I think it's really good. You really hit that, because a lot of times we do need to like put things out there. When I do put something out too hard for my child, right when they hit it, I almost instantly know this was too hard. It's that parenting instinct, like you talked about. But sometimes you just don't know, like when you're putting your lesson plan together, is it going to be hard or not?
And then sometimes yeah. they surprise you by doing something and that perhaps yes. you didn't think they could do. And I've had that numerous
exactly.
times.
Yes. Deborah also asked if, just quickly, do you grade your son's work and how do you assess mastery?
So I do grade the work, but I don't assign letter grades. Basically he does, tests that are part of the curriculum that we use. I grade them yeah. in certain subjects. I always correct to 100, which means when we get done with the test, as long as it wasn't like a complete failure to understand the concept, I know he knows the concept. He got a certain right. number of questions wrong. We go through, we talk about it, and I correct that up to 100, and I will assign an appropriate grade as far as his transcripts. But I don't mark on the paper, you got an A, you got a B, you got an F. I don't even mark percentages. I keep track of that in my records. Yeah. But he is not locked into, for my son, the idea of I have to get this in order to be a good student. I know right. that in his math, yeah. if he's passing his test at 80%, he is doing great. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is just phenomenal for him. And in different subjects, it's different. My son can memorize and spell words like nobody's business. For him to get less than a 95 on a spelling test means he probably wasn't trying hard enough. But in other subjects, I know that.
Right,
I know
exactly.
that because I know what he's done.
Right.
So I can gauge his progress based on where he is and where he's growing, not necessarily. Mm-hmm. So like in all of his subjects, they don't all have the same grading scale. In all of his subjects, I don't use that.
That's a great point to make. Yeah,
mostly that's for me keeping records. I don't project that to my son. Like you got an A, you got a gold star. I mean, I tell him he does good when he does good, but I don't need him to think, you know, here's the levels, and I got to be at this level, or I'm somehow not succeeding. For him, what would be considered a B for somebody in math is super succeeding, and I celebrate that. So, hopefully that answered the question.
That's a great answer. I don't know if anybody's ever answered it like that. You know, we do have to have different scales for different things, because our kids are all over the board and they shouldn't be kept up to the same standard when the struggle is so hard. They are trying, you know,
absolutely.
And they're working just the same as in anything. Yes, exactly. Progressing. That's most important. Well, Douglas, this has been an amazing conversation. We are already at the end of our hour. We could talk for more hours. We'll have to have you back.
anytime.
But hopefully, you have answered a lot of ways to conquer just these regular challenges that we have before us and how to succeed. And just by staying in our own lane, doing what we're called to do, you know, that run the race you've been called to. And God works all things out. So
yes, he does.
Appreciate all of your wisdom and your input.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So next week we are going to be talking about how to time box school days based on student energy rhythms. And so you'll notice your kids have different times that they do school. And so we're going to talk a lot about that with our guest next week. And so you want to join us back here for that. But I'm also going to share in the show notes, Dr. Douglas Petersma has shared a bunch of articles that he's written. And so I'm going to share those links with you so that you can read more extensively. A lot of them go into the same type of topics that we have been discussing and have further. You have a lot of links within them to research and places that you've kind of pulled a lot of this info. So lots of great resources. So, well, we appreciate all your time. Thank you all for watching us. Make sure you join our mailing list so that you can submit questions, get the newsletter the night before, so you know what guest we're going to have on and what you can ask. And so, yeah. And then, donate Sped Homeschool is a nonprofit, and this broadcast is supported by your donations and support. So thank you, everybody, and have a great week. And we'll see you next week here on Empowering Homeschool Conversations. Bye, everybody. And God bless. I want to take just a second to thank the team at Life Audio for their partnership with us on this podcast. If you go to lifeaudio.com, you'll find dozens of other faith-centered podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
This has been Empowering Homeschool Conversations.
Hello, my name's Rachel Carmen, and I want to invite you to come over and listen to my podcast. It's called Real Refreshment. For years and years as a young mother, I chased after the wind, thinking that the world could offer me the refreshment I longed for. But it was only when I discovered it in the person of Jesus Christ that I really found refreshment. Come on over and join me as we dig into Bible study. I'll see you there.